In case you missed this morning's Off The Ball breakfast,
we had this.
Can fans bottle?
Go on, I'm struggling. Is this a Cork hurling thing?
What is that, lad?
I mean, Cork
is new.
But yes. So any Cork hurling fans I've been talking to over the last few weeks, they're stricken by a kind of terror.
And we also had this.
The call to arms, like, Tipperary are at the exact same crack. I was in the Horse and Jockey last night. And Liam Cahill and Jake Morris were at the exact same crack. I hope the Tipperary fans can get a hold of tickets, because we are going to need them. And, well, Jesus, they were worth an extra point last weekend, weren't they?
Hey.
The way they celebrated Noel McGrath's wide into the hill. So
you can catch everything from this morning's Off The Ball breakfast elsewhere on the Go Loud app, and every weekday morning from 7:30.
The Football Show on Off The Ball.
With William Hill, you can boost your winnings on every game with new Bet Builder Extra. Only with William Hill. Download the app today. 18+ gamblingcare.ie.
This is News Talk.
Yes, indeed, a little hiatus from our summer break on the Football Show tonight. We are live with you until 10 p.m. because there's plenty of football happening. We've got Club World Cup going on, we've got Euro 2025 going on, but most importantly, we've got Shells versus Linfield going on for the Irish football fans. Stephen Doyle is at Talca Park. What is after happening, Steve-O?
Oh, big goal on. It's coming to 58th minute, and it came after a triple substitution made by Shelburne manager Joey O'Brien. His predecessor Damien Duff was always praised for making the right change at the right time. Well, Joey O'Brien has done just the same. On come Dan Kelly, Tyreek Wilson and Sean Boyd, the man myself and Keith Tracy mentioned. Off goes Evan Caffrey, Ali Coote and James Norris in the 56th minute. 2 minutes later, a header forward from JJ Lunny from his own half into the Linfield half, and it flicked off the head of Becco into the path of Sean Boyd. He used his big frame to shield the ball from a Linfield challenge. So strong. He's absolutely impossible to get off the ball. And then he teed up Mupo Adebeko, who is running in through onto the edge of the box, and he picked up the ball, hit it with his left foot through two Linfield players. Might have taken a deflection on the way through, but that was always destined for goal, and it rippled the back of the net in the 58th minute. So it is Shelburne 1, Linfield 0, and Talca Park has been rocking since then.
Keith, this was a brilliant goal.
Yeah, really good goal, and it's exactly what I would envisage when I thought, bring on Sean Boyd. As soon as the ball drops, and as Stephen said, one of the Linfield players is trying to get close, and he just boshes him out of the way, just gives it to Odebeko, and Odebeko does really well, shifts the ball from his right to his left. It's a bit of a scuffy shot, but it goes into the corner, and it's no more than Shelburne have deserved. But Shelburne haven't kept an awful lot of clean sheets this season, only 5 clean sheets in 25 league games, so I wouldn't, you know, be telling Shelburne, that's it now, go and take the 1-0 lead. They really should smell blood here and try and go and get the second and make it an awful lot easier for next week, because they've been on top, they've been the better team, and it's only their own little mistakes here or there that have let Linfield into it. So really go and stand on the jugular now.
Sean Boyd getting the assist for that goal. You both called for his introduction, and then moments after he does get introduced, he has a potentially match-winning intervention. Why isn't he always starting for this team?
I'm not too sure. If it was up to me, I absolutely love him. You know, having been a winger, whenever you're being pressed and you feel like you've no way out, it's the easiest out ball in the world, just to chip one into the channel or chip one up and around to the 18-yard box into Sean Boyd's chest. And he's so big that centre-halves just can't deal with him. And even if they do come and get something on the ball, Meepo should be in and around trying to pick up seconds. Hardy Wood also the same. So I think that's the best plan A for Shelburne, is Sean Boyd through the middle, go direct back to front for him. I think that goes a long way into why Shelburne won the league last season. Obviously, Sean Boyd was a big part to do that. I've heard stuff about maybe Boydie's knees not being right, having the odd injury here or there, and maybe he can't play week after week. But when he does come on, oh, he makes a big difference.
Yeah, he certainly does. Steve, what's your theory on that, on Sean Boyd and why he's not always in the starting 11?
I think it's just inconsistency on, like, right. he can be a good goal scorer, but he can be a bit streaky, and as Keith rightly mentioned as well about the injuries, like, he had an injury there which kept him out for 8 league matches, and then he came back, and since then he's played in 6 matches since then. He's been used sparingly. He started 3, came on as a sub in 3, but I think that what the crucial thing was, I think Joey O'Brien was brave enough to play 2 up top. Like, he could have taken Odebeko off because he wasn't getting much of a touch of the ball, but he left him on, and Sean Boyd Boyd as well. And it's kind of shades off the opening match of the season against Derry City when they were up against the back three. They started with a front two, Odebeko and Sean Boyd, and they were sensational that night. They hammered Derry City 3-1. Everybody thought Shelburne are going to be the team to beat this season as the title holders, and also because they put on such a good performance on that first night. We all know what's happened then. Odebeko with a shot here in the turn inside the box. It's blocked away though. They're trying to keep the pressure on Linfield inside the area. They're looking a bit rattled now, the team from Belfast. But just to go back to Odebeko and Boyd, I think the fact that he was brave enough to keep the two of them on together, and that's going to cause Linfield a huge amount of problems now, because they do have that, I suppose, Shelburne have that little bit more leeway to play two players up front as opposed to Linfield with the one man up front and trying to pack up their defence in midfield. And it's been brave by Joey O'Brien, but as Keith says as well, I think it's really important. They have to get a second here tonight. They do smell blood, so they have to get a second goal here and make it really hard for Linfield when they go up to Windsor Park.
Okay, Steve-O, thank you for that. Keith, you'll be keeping an eye on this as well. 65 minutes on the clock. It's Shells 1, Linfield 0. There was a couple of other bits and pieces that we wanted to chat about. We'd mentioned Evan Ferguson at the top of the show, and there's a lot happening in the transfer window at the moment. Arsenal making some very interesting moves, Keith. There's a couple of different layers to this. David Ornstein reporting this evening that Arsenal have made an offer to Chelsea, or have at least inquired to Chelsea about Nani Madueke. How do you feel about this?
Yeah, look, Madueke is obviously a very, very talented boy. He's over at the Club World Cup now with Chelsea. I believe Arsenal are going to hang fire until that's done and dusted before they actually put together a formal bid. Again, look, I think he's a brilliant player. I would love to have him at Arsenal, but if it's Madueke and no centre forward, then no Madueke. I would go all out for a centre forward. And I said it before, I'm delighted Zubimendi has signed. He's a player that will uses the ball really well, passes forward more than the players than we have in the middle right now. But we need a centre forward, you know, so often over the last 2 years, maybe even a little bit more. Every Arsenal fan, any Premier League fan has been looking at Arsenal and thinking they need a centre forward to be able to compete and really go with Liverpool and Manchester City, or as strong as I'm assuming Manchester City will be next year. The Norgaard one, he looks like it's going to be done from Brentford. I like him. He's a good player. He'll be somebody that will fill holes from time to time. But if you bring in Madueke, does that mean we're just finished with Eze? Because I don't think there's an awful lot between Ibrici Eze and Nani Madueke.
Wingers, what about Rodrigo? He's the other man in the
Rodrigo
mix
as well. I'm hearing whispered that there could be a move to Saudi Arabia for Rodrigo, okay. And the Arsenal one is maybe put onto the back burner. I would love Rodrigo to come in, but, you know, Eze, Madueke, Rodrigo, the money that you would have to spend to get those three lads in the door is astronomical, and I would put all three of them together and go and get a centre forward. I know Joe Pedro has just gone to Chelsea, but could Arsenal not got ahead of that? Could they put that package together and go and get an Ollie Watkins? Could they go and really test the resolve of an Isak at Newcastle? I know they've got brilliant finance, but you'd imagine Isak maybe is thinking, I'd rather play at, you know, inverted comments, a bigger club. I know Newcastle are huge at the minute, but the Gyökeres one with Arsenal looks like it's moving closer. I know Gyökeres has said he wants to go to the Emirates, but I've seen an awful lot of them, and, you know, so often I've seen players come from the Portuguese league and not set the world on fire. I'm not saying Gyökeres is going to come to the Emirates and it's not going to go well. It could really go well, but I'm not too sure. I don't think it's a match made in heaven. I think it can be, but I think there's an awful lot of work to be done on Gyökeres' side to be a number one striker at an elite club in England.
Like what?
I don't think he's the best finisher in the world. Right. I think that, you know, people will type in Gyökeres on YouTube now and they'll see he's finished and think, what's he talking about? He can finish, but, you know, he's also very, very raw. I remember his days at Coventry where you're looking and thinking, yeah, okay, there could be something there. But I've got to be honest, I didn't see an elite club in England coming to get him. I do think it's a gamble, but, you know, when you're listening to Manchester United possibly going for Jamie Vardy and Dominic Calvert-Lewin, it just goes to show you that there is, you know, there's not an awful lot of number 10s out there for, you know, good value money. So Gyökeres, I think 70, 75 million is probably a little bit overpriced. But
is there someone else you had in mind that they could have, like obviously Pedro, but somebody that's available now?
Well, maybe Guirassy, Borussia Dortmund. I like him. I think he's a good striker. Some of his stats in terms of the Champions League has been really good. But again, I'm sure Borussia Dortmund have the finances to make Arsenal pay through the nose room. So there's always going to be an element of risk. But Gyökeres, for me, I'm not too sure.
So say if it is Gyökeres, because it looks like the most likely number nine that they will sign, and you could add one of Madueke, Eze, or Rodrigo to the mix, which one of the three are you picking?
Probably Eze, yeah. Look, Rodrigo, straight off the bat, you're thinking, oh yeah, I really like him. What I've seen of him at Real Madrid, wonderful, wonderful player. But, you know, in terms of playing week in, week out for Real Madrid, week in, week out for Arsenal, if he does come, I just think Eze would be an easier move, given the fact that he's played in London at Crystal Palace. He's doing really well. You would imagine moving down the road to the Emirates wouldn't be too much of an upheaval for Eze. So I think Eze would be the easiest one and one that would hit the ground. I like Madueke, obviously at Chelsea, the same London thing applies. Rodrigo's a wonderful player, but out of the three, I would take a Brici Eze.
Okay, very interesting. And also the fact that Lyon having their relegation overturned and Crystal Palace's Europa League contention potentially in the bin as a result, maybe Eze will be agitating for a bit of a move, so it kind of makes sense. It's interesting to see Tottenham Hotspur going after someone like Mohamed Kudus, whether or not they'll that could sign, sealed and delivered, or it looks like it's pretty much over the line at this point, actually. That looks like it's going to be a move that's really going to benefit Spurs, like really good piece of business, I would have thought.
Yeah, look, every West Ham game I've done last season, I've enjoyed Mohamed Kudus. He is one that from time to time his work rate will come down a bit. If he's, you know, if he's not really in the game, he can become a little bit disillusioned and not work as hard as he should. But I'm sure Thomas Frank will let him know the standards that Spurs require, and I'm sure he will meet those. Out of possession, he will have to work an awful lot harder, but a very, very talented boy. And that Spurs team that I'm sure Thomas Frank will try and mould together will be an awful lot more stubborn, an awful lot harder to beat. They will have an awful lot better shape on them, and you'd imagine with a ball carrier like Kudus, they'll have big, big weapons next season.
Yeah. Then we move on to what Manchester United have done so far this year. Mateus Cunha coming into the club, taking the number 10 jersey. This really is not a question about Mateus Cunha, because they have signed quality players in the past and they have flattered to deceive in the structure of Manchester United. Do you have any hope that this is going to be different, that this is a big money signing that's actually going to be, you know, the Wolves player that we saw, but on a higher level and like worthy of the number 10 jersey at Manchester United?
Yeah, I'm not too sure. There's an awful lot of egos in Old Trafford at the minute. Bruno Fernandes is one of them. I'm not so sure if there's room for Mateus Cunha and Bruno Fernandes in the same team. Sometimes that United team last season didn't work as hard as they should. Mateus Cunha is one that I look at and think extremely talented boy. Love him to bits. Would love him to have gone to Arsenal. But when he doesn't have the ball, he can become a little bit of a liability at times. And with the way Ruben Amorim will want to press with his 3-4-3, there's no passengers. There can't be any passengers. And Mateus Cunha comes down a couple of levels out of possession, it will be noticeable. So I think he's a very, very talented boy. And if he gets to the work rate that he needs to, he will be a brilliant sign. And the Mbeumo one is starting to make me a little bit nervous in terms of Manchester United fans, because it seemed like it was going to happen. But it looks like they're holding out for 65 million and maybe add-ons, which possibly is starting to price Manchester United away from it. But the Mbeumo one is one I would like to see happen, because I believe he's been brilliant for Brentford for probably 2 years now, and he deserves a big move.
That'd be a nice break for Keith Andrews.
Yeah, it would be. It would be nice for Keith to keep his Mbeumo in. As long as he keeps Wissa, obviously he's going to lose Norgaard. He's lost a goalkeeper as well. Yeah, I think that's the main thing that Keith will have to do with Brentford, is try and rearrange the thinking, because top half finished last season on the coattails of European football. I think with the turnover of players, with the manager leaving, I think Brentford's aim for next season has to be to stay in the league, and maybe a lot of Brentford fans don't want to hear that.
Yeah. So what will he be judged on then? Like, obviously, if they're in the relegation places after 2-3 months of the season, his job is going to be in danger. But if they're just hovering there, saying 16th, do you think there'll be patience shown by that club for him to get this gig on a longer term?
I think he has to have a little bit of a buffer. He can be 15th in the league, but you know, if he's 2 points away from the drop zone, then I think Brentford could get a little bit nervous and a little bit itchy. The fact that, look, I look at Leeds, Sunderland and Burnley coming up, and ultimately, you know, I know the transfer window hasn't closed shut just yet, but I'm looking at them and thinking they'll be the three to go back down. It's going to be a massive hill for them to climb. Brentford, you know, they've been swimming against the current for so long now. They lost Ivan Toney 2 years ago. I did think they struggled, but then Mbeumo and Wissa and Norgaard have all come to the party. Now they've lost Thomas Frank, and you're thinking maybe there's something there again. They just seem to be one of those clubs that doesn't matter the turnover, doesn't matter the talent pool that leaves the building, they just keep on trucking. But I hope for Keith Andrews' sake they keep moving along nicely.
Just to go back to Manchester United, what about those that are on the way out, the likes of Sancho, Rashford, Garnacho, Anthony, or maybe not the ones on the way out, the ones that Manchester United fans would like to ship out, and they have complicated contractual situations with which to navigate?
Yeah, it's such a strange one, because I'm looking at the Sancho one, and obviously Chelsea have paid a fee not to take Sancho to Chelsea, which is crazy that you have to pay because you don't want the player. That's got to have obviously hurt Sancho a little bit. I'm hearing Juventus are sniffing around for him, but look, Chelsea have brought in Jamie Gittens from Borussia Dortmund, wonderful, wonderful player. He's very, very young. Obviously, João Pedro going in, Liam Delap. They've got a good pool there, Chelsea. You know, I look at Chelsea and I think I like them. The amount of turnover the players, I listed them a couple of days ago with JD, the turnover the players is absolutely mental. 140 million spent on three players already. But I really do like them, but I just think there's, when it's that amount of turnover, there's going to be a few holes that teams will find, and, you know, playing in the Club World Cup as well, I think will be probably worth between 5 and 10 points when you get onto the home stretch of next season. So I think the legs at the end of the season might come back and get Chelsea, the fact that they're in the Club World Cup. But I'm sure Chelsea and the hierarchy will be saying, if we can go and win it, I believe they bank in around 100 million.
What did you make of this Mikey Johnston story, the links to Flamengo?
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? Like, there was never links like that when I was playing. There was never, you know, you might get something in Italy or Spain or Germany, but Brazilian team coming knocking on the door is quite unheard of. It's one that would absolutely terrify me. You know, when I was young, I went to England, and that was as far as a field as I was willing to go. But, you know, Brazil, Mikey Johnson must be thinking, you know, the standard of football would be brilliant. Everything around it would be brilliant. But, you know, going to a different country, different language, very, very intense football nation over there. You would have to hit the ground running, you would feel. You would have to immerse yourself in the culture. But I feel it, from what I'm hearing, it's been put on the back burner, but it's something that Mikey Johnson must have been really fancying for it to get that far.
Yeah, it was a mental story, really. But, like, so in your career, there was obviously wasn't anything with regards to a link to a Rio de Janeiro club, but was there moves abroad that were in the offing from time to time?
I didn't get close to going to LA Galaxy. There was a little flirt with LA Galaxy for a while when Robbie Keane was there. Orlando as well, there was a little flirt with it. But no, never really thought about going too far away. Like I said, the two American clubs, but that was while I was leaving England, and my brother was actually in Whelan's at an Ed Sheeran gig and bumped into Robbie Keane, and they got chatting, and Robbie asked Martin if I would fancy coming on trial. I think LA Galaxy were coming over to play against Shamrock Rovers, so they said, look, play a half for Shamrock Rovers, play a half for LA Galaxy, and then follow us to pre-season. But to be honest with you, I was deep in the midst of me drinking at the time, so I couldn't sort myself out to go and do it. And it's one I look back on and think could have been knocking around LA for a while.
Yeah, playing with Robbie Keane at that point. Yeah, LA Galaxy. Yeah, God, that was like the moment when we thought that the MLS might actually explode into life, and that was going to be the time.
Well, I got the phone call from Orlando to see if I was interested. He had Kaká and Robinho in the team at the time, and I thought, Kaká, Robinho, Tracy, it just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
Messi, Suarez, Neymar, yeah, that sort of level of trio. Yeah, like it's amazing how I think there needs to be something done properly on the Mikey Johnston link to Flamengo. How exactly they encountered his talent, what exactly they did to find him, or who recommended him. Like the fact that Robbie Keane played a part in his story as well and went on Brazilian television to sort of stick up for him and say that he would be a good signing. Like imagine how vulnerable you would be to becoming a villain down there if you didn't hit the ground running, or the criticism you'd be open to if you weren't actually a hit immediately. I'd say he could be scapegoated pretty quickly.
Yeah, I can imagine you could be. You know, the Brazilians are a fierce footballing nation, you know, very, very flamboyant. And Mikey Johnson is a flamboyant winger. He's somebody who gets you really excited when he has the ball at his feet. But as I say, if you go there and for one reason or another, it doesn't quite happen. Very, very hot over there. Obviously, Mikey wouldn't be too used to that. But as I say, if it didn't go well, you can imagine you'd be thrown under the bus pretty quickly over there.
Should say it's still 1-0 to Shelburne after 78 minutes at Talca Park. Meepo with a speculative effort from the edge of the box there, Keith, which hits the top of the ticket office or some structure behind the goal.
I think it bounced into somebody's backyard and it was that bad.
Yeah, I think it hops on top of it and then into the next house. What have you made of Meepo overall in a Shell jersey?
I think he's hit and miss. I think he can be very good. I wouldn't quite go as strong as Roddy Collins on him being the worst finisher in Ireland. I don't think he's the best finisher, but he's shown in flashes that he can finish, he can hit the back of the net. But I think when you've got Meepo and Sean Boyd, you've got big, strong target man, you've got a quick man in Odebeko who can run the channels. I think if you use his ability, get him into good opportunities, yeah, I think he can be effective, but he can be also very, very raw and very wasteful at times. And I think that's why we see him in a shell short right now.
It's 3-1 to France now, by the way, at the Euros. They're up against Wales. Madjeri has scored a goal after 53 minutes there. So they're 3-1 up against Wales. Fishlock with the goal for Wales, which actually equalised for them in the 13th minute. And at the Club World Cup, it is Paris Saint-Germain 3, Real Madrid 0 after 55 minutes there. This hasn't really caught your attention, has it?
No, it hasn't, to be honest. And I make no apologies for it. I don't... Yeah. I don't think you can have a Club World Cup without the champions of Italy, the champions of Spain and the champions of England. It doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. I know it's on a point system and how far you go in the Champions League and blah de blah de blah, but Liverpool are the champions of England and they're not there. You know, Napoli are the champions of Italy and they're not there. Barcelona are the champions of Spain and they're not there. It just doesn't make sense to me. You know, you can throw 100 million prize money and everybody's interested, but it doesn't get my juices flowing.
No. Mine either. It's Chelsea that await the winner of that in the final this Sunday. We're going to take a quick break and then Rachel O'Sullivan from Girls on the Ball is going to talk to us about England being back in the picture for Euro 2025, and we'll also check in on Stephen Doyle at full time at Talca Park. Back in a few.
Football on Off the Ball
with William Hill. You can boost your winnings on every game with new Bet Builder Extra. Only with William Hill. Download the app today. 18+ gamblingcare.ie.
This is News Talk.
News Talk Daily with me, Ciara Doherty, is where we take a deep dive into the stories you care about.
Do you believe somebody like Graham Dwyer can be rehabilitated?
At this point in his life and at this point in the development of neuroscience, I would say not.
90s were class.
They were.
Just so you're all aware, the 90s is where it was at. Okay, I need to take a moment here.
News Talk Daily, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Conversation that counts. Best Menswear Summer Sale now on. Everything in store and online reduced up to 50%. Boss, Hilfiger, Lacoste, Marco Capelli, Bugatti. Bestmenswear.com.
House of Tiles, genuine 10-day summer sale now on. Our top 20 selling tiles reduced to half price. Our top 3 selling laminate floors reduced to $9.99 a square yard. Stores at Long Mile Road, Sandyford, Robin Hood, Coolock and Blanchardstown. 10-day summer sale now on. Visit houseoftiles.ie.
What makes us love our county so fiercely, despite all the summers of hurt? What lifts us back up year after year after year? What stirs such passion in our hearts and brings us out in our thousands? It's something intangible, deep in our veins. It's our county. It's our people. It's in our blood. AIB, the toughest. Proud sponsors of the All-Ireland Senior Football Championship.
Access to the all-new Audi A5 e-hybrid is all yours. With up to 110 kilometres of electric range, experience electric power and engine performance combined. Discover all the advantages to owning a new Audi A5 e-hybrid with introductory incentives and Audi all-access offers, including the business pack with sports seats, upgraded sound system and more. Terms and conditions apply. Audi. Vorsprung durch Technik.
Supercool solar, solar-licious, evergreen. It's hard to choose a solar installer. Or is it?
I mean, will they give you a 2-year guarantee on the insulation? A 25-year warranty on the panels? 24-hour monitoring of your system? Have they been in business over 40 years? And is there €400 off the cost right now? With Bord Gáis Energy, that's a yes times 5. So maybe it's not so hard to choose. Book a free solar consultation today at bordgáisenergy.ie. Terms and conditions apply.
Football on Off the Ball.
With William Hill, you can boost your winnings on every Premier League game with new Bet Builder Extra. Only with William Hill. Download the app today. 18+ gamblingcare.ie.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome back. 84 minutes on the clock at Talca Park, and it is still Shelburne 1, Linfield 0. We're turning our attention now, though, to Euro 2025. Two hammerings dished out today, really, unless there's a massive comeback from Wales against France. England beating Netherlands 4-0 earlier on. France currently 4-1 up against Wales. 67 minutes on the clock there. Grace Gayoro has just scored in the 63rd minute there to open up a bit of a gap that we expected. But to reflect mostly on that England win earlier, I'm delighted to say that Rachel O'Sullivan from Girls on the Ball is back with us. Rachel, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you guys?
Very well. So England are back in the frame, you'd have to say, after that result.
Yeah, I think the nature of the win as well, scoring so many goals against the Dutch, you know, I think they went in knowing they had to win and then, you know, hope to try and score a lot against Wales. But I think putting four past the Netherlands, yes, they still have to beat Wales, but potentially that pressure of putting a lot past them or more than the Dutch did is maybe eased slightly. And of course, I think they still need the Dutch to beat France.
Yeah, they certainly do. The way this has worked out now for England is that themselves and Spain may not meet until a final. Because I think the top group, at the top of England's group, will most likely be in a collision course with Spain in the semi-final, right?
Yeah, I mean, it would mean that they face, I believe, Germany in the quarterfinal. So it's not like an easy route. Right. I guess it's the lesser of two evils, I suppose. But yeah, I think arguably coming second is the group is slightly more favourable, I'd put it that way.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. So talk us through what England did differently today, if we start with how Serena Wiegmann actually set up her team compared to how they set up against France.
What did England do differently? Everything. I think a lot of players had off days against France, didn't turn up. You know, that sometimes happens with maybe one or two players. It seemed to happen with the majority of the squad. You know, Jess Carter really struggled and left back against France. It was definitely an area that they targeted. She came into central defence tonight with Alex Greenwood going out into the left. Beth Mead was on the bench for Lauren James, and Ella Toon came in then in the midfield. So it provided a little bit more robustness, a little bit more physicality and defensive support in that midfield area while still retaining Lauren James's creativity, which we obviously saw with her two goals. So, yeah, a few little tweaks, but equally I think the Dutch really got their tactics wrong. It was kind of hard to wrap your head around what they'd set out to do. They were super narrow. They were, you know, not very present in the press, kind of a half press, which is not something you do against England when they're in their kind of fluid attacking style, which is what they were doing. So unusual tactics from the Dutch, but I think Wiegmann got it spot on tonight.
What was the Lauren James role tonight?
Lauren James is out on the right wing rather than playing in the 10. So, you know, that I think the Lauren James question was always does she start or does she finish in the France game? And it was a gamble either way. Like, you might, had she scored, say, that early chance against France in the first minute, it would have been a very different game. So I don't really have an issue with her being started. It was one or the other for England. And, you know, you think maybe we start her and we get up in the game and she can come off after 60, or we're down in the game, we bring her on. You know, you don't really know until the game starts. So I had no issue with her starting, but I think that midfield area was where England were overrun against France. So bringing in Toon had a superb game, and keeping James on, but in the right, you still managed to retain that wonderful creativity that she shows and that flair and that ability to finish like she does.
Yeah, like that strike for the first goal was absolutely fantastic, but the other piece of magic in that first goal is Hannah Hampton's long ball, and it kind of looks like a goal kick, but it's from open play and it's clearly almost like a set piece, and you can kind of tell everybody's in motion when it happens that this is something that they've actually worked on.
Yeah, Route 1 football, it's something Hannah Hampton is known for, is her distribution. And it was a thing of beauty, finding Alessia Russo the way she did, the pass from Russo So in, you know, I think we saw that a lot, not just from Hampton, but across the back line, there were long balls being sent forward behind the Dutch, and it seemed to work every time. There was, Lauren Hemp was afforded so much space on the left. There was balls being pinged in from Williamson, from Greenwood, from Carter, and of course from Hampton as well. So it's a weapon to have another player back there who can be so accurate with those balls.
Definitely. She was like Ederson. And like there's Route 1 football in the most beautiful infrastructure. Like if Pep Guardiola is a proponent of this, then everybody should be a proponent of this. Like, is this something that we see her doing for Chelsea week in, week out?
Week in, week out, Chelsea do like to play from the back, but it's an option that they provide. And I think when you know your goalkeeper can be so accurate, it's just another weapon in the armoury that Chelsea have, and Chelsea have an awful lot of weapons. So, yeah, like I said, it's something...
We might just give that line another dial up there, Rachel. Sorry to interrupt, but yeah, that's just breaking up on us. Keith, another big opportunity there for Linfield.
Yeah, it was a ball into the channel, and initially I didn't catch which Shelbourne defender it was, but he'd done really well, come across, won the ball, and he's in his own 18-yard box. He lays the ball back to Cairns to go and get rid of it. The Linfield striker gets on his bike and closes him down. He gets a big block on the ball. For half a second, I thought he deflected it back into the Shelbourne goal, but it hit the side netting. And it's those little moments that will be giving Linfield just a little bit of, you know, just a little bit of, there might be something here for them. They've been second best for, you know, most of this game, but they've had little chances here and there, and it's generally been because of a lack in concentration from Shelbourne or some bad play. So just need to see this one over the line. I know it's only 1-0, and ideally Shelbourne would have wanted more, but sometimes you've got to take what you can, and if that's a 1-0 win, it's a 1-0 win.
I think the way in which this game has panned out, as a ball breaks to a Shells player in the middle of the box with a couple of yards of space and he actually just doesn't connect with it at all, Linfield would be delighted with this. 1-0 going back up to the North next Wednesday. This really couldn't have gone any better for them given the amount of opportunities and the amount of ball that Shelbourne had. We do have Rachel back with us. Rachel, we were just chatting about Hannah Hampton, and what I was going to ask you about was just being the successor to Mary Earps and the pressure that kind of comes with that. But it seems that she's a very different kind of goalkeeper.
Yeah, she's got different attributes. And I think we had seen previously when Earps was still around that sometimes Hampton would come in a game like a Spain game where that ball over the top and that accurate long ball passing was a really valuable thing to have against a team like Spain who press high and, you know, love that possession-based football. So the two goalkeepers kind of had those different attributes. Yes, there was a bit of pressure for her going in, more so because she didn't have perhaps a guiding hand of an experienced goalkeeper behind her in camp. She's been in and around camps before and major tournaments, but to be the starting goalkeeper, knowing that your backups, neither of whom have any caps, is pressure. But she's been in high pressure situations. She's been playing for Chelsea and obviously playing very well for Chelsea and winning with Chelsea, and that I think will have set her up perfectly.
When you're following this team at the moment, are you now getting the sense that particularly after this evening's result that there's going to be a big movement towards Switzerland from people who aren't necessarily out there yet, who are hoping to hop on at the knockout stages, and generally what sort of atmosphere are you getting around this tournament? Because like comparing it with 2022, it feels like an unfair comparison given it was their home tournament and there was a Wembley final. But are you feeling that level of buzz around this team similarly this time?
I think it's growing. England had the second highest ticket allocations or UK addresses, so 40,000 okay. Tickets. And I know, I think about 3,000 of them were Wales. So there has been a large number of tickets bought. I think it was just the Germans who bought more than 60,000 tickets. And I do know of a number of people who kind of said, we're coming out for the final game and we're coming out for the group stages. And I imagine watching that first thought, perhaps we've gambled on this. So yes, I do believe there'll be more coming, but there's been a pretty good contingent so far.
We are keeping an eye on what's happening in the Wales game at the moment. It's going to be a disappointing evening for them. Like when they equalise after 13 minutes and Jess Fishlock scores, you think, geez, there could be something incredible about to happen here. But just for Jess Fishlock at the end of an awesome career, for her to be the first goal scorer for Wales in a major tournament, that's a pretty amazing moment, even if it'll be a disappointing result for her tonight.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I have a friend here who happened to come out and say, oh, did Wales score? Who scored? And we were like, I mean, how can you even ask who scored? Of course, it was Jess Fishlock, the record goal scorer. I think perhaps that has been one of the difficult things for Wales, is not really having that out-and-out number nine to target. You know, your best goal scorer is a midfielder. But at the same time, it's no surprise that it is her that goes up and gets that goal. So delighted for her to get that moment. You know, they managed to get that qualification just in time for a Jess Fishlock, who's been so intrinsic to this Welsh team and the growth of the team. And it would have been so unfair for them to maybe qualify for the next one and for her to have missed out on that. So she's gotten her moment, a well-deserved moment, but understandably a difficult night against France.
I mean, I'd have been happy enough if Jess Fishlock missed out entirely if the team that they were up against
Some
in the playoff.
Die.
A couple of other bits and pieces. Your general take on Spain at the moment. Favourites going into the competition, stronger favourites now, I suspect. Are we learning anything new about them? Do you feel stronger about them after seeing them play?
I think a bit of both. I think, yes, they were my favourites going in. I expected them to do well. I think in the group that they had, I could only see Spain topping that group. You know, I think Portugal really, really struggled against them. And, you know, I try not to get too carried away because you have to factor in the opposition that they're playing. I thought Belgium exposed some very small chinks in the armour, but they've shown how you can get at Spain. Those over-the-top direct balls, counter-attacking, you know, I do think Arena Paredes, some of their defence struggle with that kind of direct route. And, you know, Belgium had a goal ruled out. They had a one-on-one just saved by the goalkeeper. So Belgium were certainly able to get in, but they're a team that can't sustain that kind of game plan that you need against Spain. And, you know, they just watched the final two balls, fifth and sixth goal, go in, as did I, you know, rather than actually defending them. But the quality in the Spanish team is superb. The youngsters, Pina, Vicky Lopez has had to step in Aitana Bonmati's absence. And also, I think Esther Gonzalez, having her on form and having a number nine, a direct number nine that they can target, was perhaps something they've missed in the past. And, you know, who knew Spain had another level? But she offers that. She offers long balls over the top, which is not something we're used to seeing Spain doing. But it's another thing they're now able to do in a tournament, is not just rely on the intricate passing and the short passes up the pitch, but they can actually send a ball long and they've got a number nine who can bury it.
When it comes to Norway, they've come into their final game in the group, two wins from two. They've beaten Switzerland 2-1. They've beaten Finland 2-1. There is a sense maybe that they aren't quite the sum of their parts, and it's a bit of a theme at major tournaments for Norway.
It's a conundrum, that team. They're absolutely stacked in so many areas. You know, they struggle a bit defensively. That's always been a problem for them. But when they start to struggle in front of goal, that's the real surprise with the quality that they have. I feel that Norway have kind of tripped and fallen into the quarterfinals. You know, I think Switzerland very much deserved something out of the game. Finland deserved something out of the game. And for them to be able to get the win in both of them is huge. I think, you know, someone said to me, oh, I think they'll be exposed found out in the knockout stages. And I said, I think they've already been found out. I don't think anyone's been hugely convinced by what they've put out on the pitch. I mean, in the first game, they were playing players out of position. You know, Caroline Graham-Hansen is an unbelievable winger. She was playing central. You know, I think there's that kind of issue of playing the players in their best positions. They did that against Finland. Still, the Finns were able to get in at them and deserved, I think, at least a draw out of that game. So, yeah, it feels like a lot of individuals that don't quite seem to be able to click together. Some have questioned maybe whether Gemma Granger has been put in charge, if this job is too big for her too soon. But this isn't the first time we've talked about Norway not being able to click. So there's more than just the manager, I think, at fault. It's an unusual conundrum for sure.
There is an absolutely huge game tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock, Finland versus hosts Switzerland. If you're judging them off their performances against Norway, is it fair to say they both showed a similar enough standard?
Yeah, and actually makes it tricky to call. I thought Finland would be bottom of this group. I thought Iceland would do better. This was the first time Finland had won a Euros game in 16 years, which sounds bigger than it is rather than just four European tournaments, but it is a big stat. They've got a new manager in. He's been in for the last maybe year or so. A lot of youngsters that are very exciting and confident on the pitch, but equally, Switzerland have impressed. They've done better than I expected them to. They hadn't won a game since October 2024 coming into this tournament. They've got Pia Sundhage in charge, who was a legend in the game, and you know they're very much up for this. I think the crowd has been massively helping them. The turnout of Swiss fans has been incredible, and maybe somewhat surprising for a country that doesn't have a huge women's football presence. So they've definitely been the cliche 12th player, I think, for Switzerland. So I think it will make for a very tasty fixture.
As a host nation, then, how are they performing? It feels that the product has been excellent and there's some really, really good storylines. Like maybe like France beating England just kind of lit a flame in terms of the kind of narrative going into today in particular, and that's kind of something we needed to see. And the qualities, like the Portugal-Italy game, I saw a good bit of that on Monday. That was really, really high quality and so much drama in that as well. But in terms of a host nation, is it matching the product on the field?
Yeah, I mean, some of the stuff in and around the stadiums maybe is a little bit flatter than we had at Euro 2022 in some of the host nations. But, you know, a lot of the questions going into this tournament was the size of the stadiums and how small so many of the stadiums were, and how I think the biggest one where the final will be played only holds about 35,000 when you compare it to, say, England, and they had 89,000 or 88,000 at the final. 87,000, I think it was. So it felt a little bit like a concern that this would be a step down. But what it has allowed them to do is sell a lot of tickets at smaller grounds and make a lot of these grounds feel full. And they've actually broken records in terms of the crowds twice, in terms of the crowds turning up to non-host nation games. They've broken that record twice. They've now broken the record of the number of people attending group stage games. That happened tonight, and they still have a round of games to go. So from that perspective, they're doing very well inside the stadium, that's for sure.
And I presume the travelling around is one of the most picturesque things you can possibly do as a journalist at this particular moment in time. I mean, you're in Zurich right now, I suspect, and you're off to St. Gallen for Sunday,
yes.
I suspect. So that train ride, as is every train ride in Switzerland, is going to be unbelievable, I suspect.
Yeah, so we've been in the car, helpfully,
okay.
But at some of the stadiums we've gone to have been, Sion was one of the most picturesque stadiums. Lucerne last night was also beautiful. There's quite a few stadiums surrounded by dramatic mountains, and they certainly provide a very distracting backdrop for some of these games, and definitely some lovely lines, I think, that people can write when doing their match reports. But it's definitely a beautiful country. I don't think I've seen as much of it as I'd like, given I'm doing a game a day, but I definitely plan to once the knockout stages come in.
Rachel O'Sullivan from Girls on the Ball, thanks so much for joining us this evening.
Cheers, guys. Thanks.
Cheers. So it has gone full-time at Talca Park. Shelburne have just pipped Linfield. Half-time in this tie, Steve-O. Kind of hard to know how to sum this up, because it feels like it might not just be enough. I think Linfield will probably get a lot of joy out of that result tonight. But Shell still favourites.
Yeah, all I have to say, I think it's a poor result for Shelburne, because they are definitely technically a better footballing team. Physically, they're in better shape. As I mentioned in the first half, the Linfield captain, who went off midway through the second half, Jamie Mulgrew, he was booked as well. He looked well out of his depth. He's 39 years of age. He doesn't look in the kind of shape that any of the Shelburne midfielders are in. So you're essentially playing with an extra man. And Shelburne just didn't make the most of it. And I'm really disappointed with Shelburne, because, you know, it's the final third where they're really lacking. You know, they've got good quality attackers, Shelburne. As we've mentioned, Meepo Adebeko, the likes of Harry Wood, who had a really good game, to be fair to him. You've got Ali Coote as well, who was good in the first half, poor in the second half. The likes of John Martin, Ellis Chapman coming off the bench, Dan Kelly. These are all good players. But in the final third of the pitch, they're just really sloppy. They're crossing the final ball, just not good enough, and they can't seem to pick out a man in a good goal-scoring position. Now, the goal itself was excellent, you know, that link-up play between Sean Boyd and Meepo Adebeko, and it was a lovely finish from Adebeko, and I think he deserved that, because he did plug away hard in the second half, and he was a lot better than he was in the first. But this Linfield team, they're nowhere near Shelburne. And to come away from here with a 1-0 defeat going back to Windsor Park, when they'd be that small bit fitter in the second leg. Like, Shelburne should still do the job, but I wouldn't be too confident based on what we've seen here tonight. And I think there might be a bit of frustration among the Shelburne support.
No disagreements, Keith Tracy?
No, I think Joey O'Brien and Shelburne will think that there was possibly more there for them. I mean, Cairns, the Shelburne goalkeeper, made one save, and I would have made that save myself. He wasn't exactly stretched at any point in the game. So yeah, look, I think they were much, much, much the better team. But Mulgrew, the 39-year-old, you'd imagine that'll be a straight swap for Chris Shields in the next leg. So yeah, look, it only takes one mistake up in Windsor Park, a big pitch, it'll be slick. Linfield will have a couple of thousand fans there, so Shelburne will have it all to do. But they've got the 1-0 in the back pocket. But You know, this Shelbourne team, as I said, they don't keep an awful lot of clean sheets. They don't score an awful lot of goals. I think you can count on one hand how many times they've scored more than one goal in the league this season. So not an awful lot of goals there. But they've got the win. They're on the way up to Belfast next week. They've still got it, an awful lot of hard work to do, but they will know that if they can keep a clean sheet, they've won the game and they're through. So halfway done, but as Stephen said, I think it still leaves a little bit more to be desired, and I hope Joey O'Brien starts Sean Boyd in the next one, because I think once he made the three subs, it did make a big difference to the Shelbourne team.
Yeah, listen, Steve, we let you go and get your post-match reaction. Thank you very much for this evening, Stephen Doyle, there reporting from Talca Park. What we'll do is we'll take one last half break and get Keith's final thoughts on tonight's game at Talca.
Football on Off the Ball
with William Hill. You can boost your winnings on every game with new Bet Builder Extra. Only with William Hill. Download the app today. 18+ gamblingcare.ie.
This is News Talk.
Looking for the perfect summer escape? Embrace long, leisurely days at Killeshea Hotel. Wander through lush gardens in full bloom. Explore Kildare Village for a summer shopping spree. Marvel at Newbridge silverware or visit the Irish National Stud. Indulge in pure relaxation at our award-winning spa. Unwind in luxurious suites where warm evenings drift into peaceful nights. Killeshea, enchanting at every turn. Discover more at killesheahotel.com, part of FBD Hotels and Resorts.
Nippy, fun and chic don't often describe insurance, but they perfectly fit the electric Fiat 500 you have the opportunity to win if you get a new car policy from On Post Insurance. For great cover at a great price and a shot at the Fiat 500, get a quote at onpostinsurance.ie. Acceptance criteria, terms and conditions apply and are available at onpostinsurance.ie/promotions. Competition ends December 31st, 2025. One Direct Ireland Limited trading as On Post Insurance is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. One Direct Ireland Limited is a wholly owned subsidiary of On Post.
Summer's heating up with the big sale at Woodie's, with up to 50% off our fantastic range of garden furniture. That's up to 50% off patio sets, gazebos and stylish rattan sets. And if you'd like to bring some sizzle to the Irish summer, you'll find up to 30% off barbecues. But hurry, the Woodie's big sale is only while stocks last. Shop the way that suits you, in store, online or click and collect. Woodie's, we're all homemakers. T's and C's and exclusion supply.
Our grandfather founded Stafford's Funeral Homes in 1953. Generations later, the people we've met and the lives we've helped to celebrate continue to be our inspiration. That's why Stafford's now have some of the most comfortable facilities in Ireland and provide more choice and control for families. Inspired by our grandfather, Tom Stafford, we are proud to serve our community with the highest standards of funeral care. Stafford's. Trust our family to take care of yours.
New funeral home now open in Dunleary.
Football on Off the Ball
with William Hill. You can boost your winnings on the Sunday game with new Bet Builder Extra. Only with William Hill. Download the app today. 18+ gamblingcare.ie.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome back. It has finished Shelbourne 1, Linfield 0 after the first leg of their Champions League qualification tie. I mean, they probably progress next week, Keith, but it certainly looks a little less certain than maybe the gap between the teams looked to have provided tonight. They just didn't do the business in front of goal. But they probably didn't create a whole pile of unbelievably clear-cut chances either. It was like they peppered the goal with like half chances here and there, but maybe there wasn't that last incisive pass at any point over the 90 minutes.
Yeah, I don't think we've found out anything new about the Shelbourne team. We knew they're a little bit goal shy. They've scored an awful lot more goals than they did the previous season, but they're leaking an awful lot more goals. They don't look as defensively solid, which obviously puts the attacking players under that little bit more stress. So look, it was comfortable in a roundabout way. The 1-0 scoreline, you look and think maybe it was close. You know, it was all Shelbourne really. The Evan Caffrey hits the crossbar in the first couple of minutes from a set piece. The goalkeeper then makes a really good save and then scrambles to get it on the line. They had a penalty overturned, rightfully so. It was overturned and should have been. It was the right decision. But you know, all the pushing, all the making, all the making of chances was all Shelbourne. The tempo in the passing was good. It was just a little last bit of class. I love Ellis Chapman. What I seen of him last season at Sligo when he signed for Shelbourne, I thought that could be the signing of the season. Hasn't quite happened, but yeah, Ellis Chapman is one that I think he could be the little link from the midfield to the strikers. And look, Odebeko can be hit and miss, but I do think if you have him and Boyd as a partnership, there's enough there for them to go and get some goals. But those Lingfield players that are, you know, our season at the minute, a 39, 30 and 33 year old, they did start to look a little bit leggy in around the 60, 75 minute mark. So yeah, I'd imagine that Shelbourne will try and keep the tempo high next week, put them on the back foot. But as I say, when you're going away from home, it only takes one mistake, one bad decision, and all of a sudden Lingfield will be straight back into it and the crowd will be up. So the job is half done and Shelbourne are in the driving seat, but you would still have a few nerves for next week.
Yeah, the thing is Lingfield are still in pre-season as well. They probably haven't hit their full level either throughout this pre-season, even though they'll have known about this fixture in the state for quite some time. How do you think Joey O'Brien is getting on? What sort of job is he doing so far?
I think he's doing a really good job. When you come out with the shadow of Damien Duff, a huge figure at Shelbourne, I've called him Mr. Shelbourne over the last 4 years because he's been all encompassing, he's been all about Shelbourne. When Duffer left, people said to me, surely Joey will go in. I didn't think Joey would fancy it just because Joey and Damien Duff was such a good relationship. I thought Joey might have been happy, but it's brilliant that he stepped out of the shadow of Damien Duff. He's still unbeaten. He's played 4 games, 2 wins and 2 draws. Yeah, so he's only 39 years of age, Joey, and that's very, very young for a manager. So he's learning on the job. And he seems to be, obviously, I played against Joey back in the day for Blackburn and against Bolton. Very, very strong man, very strong-willed, very, very stubborn, loves a tackle. And I think you can see that in his team, that he don't shy away from any sort of physical battle. And just adding those little bits of quality in the final third, I think is what's haunting him. But Kerr McEnroy, Kyle Wood, Paddy Barrett, all brilliant today. But you need to keep Wood in the game for longer periods. Kerr McEnroy in the game for longer periods. And as I say, use Sean Boyd that little bit more. You don't want Sean Boyd running channel after channel. You just want them to stand there and bully people. And when he does that, that brings Meepo into the game as well. So, yeah, I think there's an awful lot for Shelbourne fans to be thinking. When Duffer went out, they're probably thinking, oh my God, this could all fall apart, with Duffer saying, I'm the one constantly driving, I'm the one at the forefront of this. You know, the Shelbourne players have reacted really, really well. And as I say, unbeaten and 4 now since Duffer went out the door. And brilliant stuff from Joey so far.
Is there a chance that if there's going to be one team who makes it to a European competition proper this year, it's actually just going to be Rovers again? I know they don't have the champions path, but they do have a Conference League playoff, which begins in a few weeks' time. So they could just win those games. We've seen that they can win games in the competition proper. Yeah. So they might actually be expected to be the ones to represent again. Whereas, is Conference League a reasonable enough expectation for a team like Shelbourne?
Yeah, I think so. Look, I honestly don't think Shelbourne and Shamrock Rovers are thinking Champions League, Conference League, Europa League. I think they look at the finances of it and think, if we can go and secure them finances, brilliant. If Shelbourne drop out of the Champions League and go into the Europa League, I don't think they'll be too fussed. As if they can somehow secure European football, it'd be wonderful. I think this is the first time in 20 years they've heard the Champions League music back in Talca Park. So it's brilliant stuff for them. I would agree that Shamrock Rovers are the ones we're looking at to go longest in the European football in terms of League of Ireland stuff. And look, depth, the talent they have, the players they have, Graham Bourke, Jack Bourne, Aaron Green, young Michael Noonan, Gaffney, they've got some brilliant, brilliant players there. And yeah, I wouldn't be saying that as a knock towards Shelbourne, that I fancy Shamrock Rovers to go deeper. It's just, given what they did last season, you'd imagine they will be there or thereabouts. And given how well they've started the League of Ireland, they can put it on the back burner for a little bit.
Does last weekend give you any pause or thought that we might have a late run at a title race? Derry absolutely hammering Waterford and Rovers unable to beat Sligo?
Look, I look at that Derry team, and there's, you know, the Northern Irish internationals they brought in. I know they're a little bit older, but they seem to have clicked all of a sudden. 7 goals on the weekend. And I look at Derry absolutely capable of beating anybody, as they've proven, but absolutely capable of getting beat by anybody as well. And I can see them, you know, matching Shamrock Rovers, earning as many points as Shamrock Rovers do, but I also see them dropping points. And I don't see anybody. I think we might get a title race out of our own, but I don't see anybody really threatening Shamrock Rovers to go beyond them. So I think the best we can hope for is that Derry keep us interested. Hopefully St. Pat's playing in Europe tomorrow. Hopefully they get a win and that kicks off their League of Ireland campaign, because they've been underwhelming so far.
Hugh Tracy, good stuff this evening. Thanks a million for coming in. We'll be keeping a close eye on that second leg next week. Now, if you miss any of tonight's show, including Wednesday Night Rugby with Anna Capeless or Paddy Burns looking ahead to the football semi-finals, it's all available now on demand for Off The Ball members only. So you can go to offtheball.com/join to become a member. Tomorrow evening, we're going to be joined by Cullum Cooper. We're going to delve into the rise of Meath football with Cullum O'Rourke and Cathal O'Brick, and we'll have the latest crappy quiz for you on a Thursday. Tom Dunn is up next. Good night.
Off The Ball Rugby.
The story is it's because it's his son, but if it was, whatever, Owen O'Brien, with that experience, it's his fourth Lions tour, he does it. This is meat and drink to him.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.